Okay, the clock on the wall says 7 o'clock. We all set to go, Ms. Lana?
Yes, we are.
All right. Welcome, everybody. Happy New Year. Reminder to the public that the meetings are being recorded. Is there any public comment on non-agenda items? Hearing none. Board members, is there anything on the consent agenda you don't like, you'd like pulled for further discussion?
Not by me.
If not, I will entertain a motion to approve the consent agenda.
Motion to approve consent agenda as presented.
Second.
Seconded.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay. See, man, see how quickly that went?
That was good.
Okay, first item, discussion and decision regarding health insurance renewal. You have the floor, my friend.
Okay, thank you. Well, for those of you who don't know me, I'm Maynard McQuiston. I lived here all my life. My dad was Sam McQuiston at O&S Hardware, if anybody remembers it. I've had your guys' group health insurance for quite a while now, and although the last year wasn't too bad, but the two previous years, we've had some bumps in the road as far as increases with the carriers. I'm sure you've seen all about it on TV. But we've got good news this year. We're starting to see some rate stabilization, and your rates actually went down. I was telling Pete before you got here that there's a rule under the Affordable Care Act called medical loss ratio that most people don't know and probably don't care to know. It's an actuarial term and has to do with actuaries and underwriting about how the government is making the insurance companies deductible and max out-of-pocket line up each year. There's a ratio, and they have to keep that ratio lined up, and if they don't meet it at the end of the year, based on the claims they've paid, they have to adjust the deductible and the max out-of-pocket, and that's why occasionally we see plans change a little bit. And thus, is your plan changed a little bit this year? So the good news is your rate went down. So what I gave you there in that photocopy is your current rates for the two plans you have. You have a gold 931, which is probably our most popular plan. And currently it's $1,000 deductible with a $40 office copay, 80-20 co-insurance with $4,000 max out-of-pocket and a full drug card. It's the plan we have for First West, 45 employees, so it's a very popular plan. You also have a gold 937, which is an HSA eligible plan that currently this year for 2018 is a $2,700 deductible 100%. That is our lowest HSA eligible plan. However, nobody is on that plan currently, which is okay. You can keep that plan and make it available to any new people or existing people if they want to change. But currently nobody's on that plan. So the gold 931 health premiums monthly currently are $5,341.80. If you look at the next page, they've dropped to $5,208.52. But that gold 931 changed a little bit. Last year's deductible was $1,000, this year it's $1,500. It's still 80-20, and it's still $4,000 max out of pocket, and it's still a $40 office copay with a full drug card. So really not much of a change. The max out of pocket stayed the same. And the HSA eligible plan that you have that nobody's on, it went from 2,700 100% to 3,000. So thus kind of tells you that the plans are changing a little bit because of the medical loss ratio. You do have vision, and the vision never changes, and I gave you the outline of coverage for that vision, and the price is $6 a person, 19 and above, and that will not change. You do have outlines of coverage for the new gold 931 with the new changes for 19 and the new HSA eligible plan that went from 2,700 to 3,000. Anybody have any questions?
Why does this discriminate so heavily towards your age?
Well, now, you bring up a good point.
The board will come to order.
Yeah. Small group in Montana, you have the choice of doing age-based rates or composite rates. Typically, composite rates hurt younger people and help older people. But you could go to composite rates if you want, and every single pays the same, every family pays the same, every family pays the same, so that is a change you could make. So it isn't a bad point. We do have some groups that do it, but because pre-Obamacare rates were 5-to-1. A 60-year-old's rate could be 5 times higher than a 20-year-old. That's been compressed to 3-to-1. So.
Any board discussion? Any staff discussion? Staff questions? Any public comment? Is there a motion to renew our health insurance?
I will make that motion to renew the health insurance.
Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
There you go, my friend.
Okay. Thank you. Lana, we don't need any paperwork.
Okay.
And it's an auto renew. We used to have to have something, but we don't need anything else.
Okay.
So we're good.
Okay.
I got this renewal, which you were welcome to.
Okay. And I'll check with Teresa if I have any questions.
The only thing I would like to say, I'll take just a few seconds here. These are key things that everybody needs to remember. You must pre-authorize every surgery and every procedure. I mention that because it's been law forever, but we see people missing doing it. So if you're going to go in for a CT, MRI, mammogram, colonoscopy, any procedure, not your doctor's office, but any procedure, you need to call the 1-800 number on the back of your card at the bottom and get it pre-authorized. Okay? Deductibles are calendar year. It seems like a thing that we all should know, but deductibles are calendar year. We have some people forgetting that as well. All small group is calendar year. If you're a large group of 51 and above employees, you can actually do a plan year. So you could go April to April. But small group is all calendar year. So, yep.
Thanks.
Thank you guys very much.
Are you in relationship with all of
them? My brother.
Yeah. Did you go to Rosemary?
You know what? I wished I would have. I did all the way to seventh grade. And then because Rosemary was private, my parents couldn't afford it. And I had made some friends in public school, so I went to public school and you went to Rosemary. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Moving along. Discussion of trustee elections. Lana, is this you?
Yes. I think somebody asked last month just to summarize where things are with the election. So just a reminder, the deadline for people filing their candidacy form is 5 p.m. on February 11th at the election office. We did place the notice in the Bozeman Chronicle on the 6th of January. It's also on our website. There's forms here in the station, and there's forms at the election office. So we're all set there.
And if we only have one candidate, just remind the board we won't have to run an election, which will save us a couple $1,000.
Right.
That person would just be
right.
Proclaimed by acclamation.
And I don't know if there's anybody has filed yet.
Any board discussion?
I would just observe that the forms have to be notarized. Unless you turn it in yourself at the election office, then they self-notarize it right there, so you don't have to go through that step of notarizing it outside. It's not a hard thing to get done, but you can go right to the office.
Right, and the ad did say that they should file the completed form at the election office, so they shouldn't bring it here.
Any public comment on the trustee election? Thanks, Amanda.
Thank you.
Okay, Jason, you're next. Discussion and decision, proposal for replacement.
No, I think I got dashboard.
Oh, sorry, dashboard.
You're
Look at that, looking so much nicer.
Yeah, so what we did, just took the input from the discussion at the last board meeting and applied that input, put the borders around the different components, split the two, changed the nomenclature, the titling on the first apparatus and equipment capital item there, and then split the two other ones, and with the idea that the two the capital improvement and capital replacement for buildings will eventually have two more elements in it similar to the first one for equipment and apparatus once we define that those amounts. And so we'll redistribute the weighting on those two different tables there once we have that information. I think Jason was going to look into one component for the capital replacement on buildings. I don't know if you have anything to discuss there, Jason. That's all I have on the dashboard, unless there's a further input for change.
So you talking about my research into how we would set aside funds for building repairs?
Right, the average. Yeah, if you found some information as to.
So I spoke with the city of Bozeman about what they do, and because of how many structures that they have to maintain within the city, whether it's library or commission buildings, it's a bit of a complicated formula. And their advice to us would just be to look at what maybe one of the more expensive repairs would be. They said things like furnaces, boilers, they don't worry too much about that they can cover that in their annual budgets, but roofs, siding, asphalt, pavement, sidewalk, that's the stuff that they kind of think about that are the bigger, redoing a parking lot or those types of things in the city so their advice to us was to just pick one of the more high dollar items that we would anticipate. And they said, you can typically hire a contractor to come out and give you an estimate for what that may cost and set those monies aside. And then when those get depleted at some point, just have a plan for replenishing it and to keep it as simple as possible.
So did they suggest that would be done at an aggregate amount for all of those things at one time, or
no.
Just take one item?
Yeah, just one of the bigger items and sock that money away for that. And then whatever the board chooses, I mean, really, as he stated, it's really at the board's discretion to decide how much of a cushion that they might want on that, because it really is a contingency plan. It's saying that we know something's going to happen at some point. We're going to have to replace a roof. We're going to have to, God help us when we have to repave this parking lot. Hopefully we won't, but that setting those funds aside for those types of activities.
So we would say a roof is going to be $25,000. So in this scenario, we would say let's throw $25,000 a year into that contingency fund.
Well, that's what I'm wondering too, if it would be per year, because I guess the approach that I would think about
just to maintain a balance.
Yeah, that's I guess the approach and an alternate approach that I thought a little bit about is that you view it from a depreciation standpoint. That if you have a building, viewing it from an economic depreciation, mm-hmm. not tax depreciation. So if you have a $2 million building or whatever, and it has, say, a 40-year useful life, and if you straight line that useful life over 40 years, and you wouldn't include the structural component, just kind of the siding, roof, all those components, and then you're basically, storing about that much money per year for all of our buildings. And so you might end up, in essence, you might end up with just a back of the envelope calculation that might end up being very similar to just picking your most expensive item. And I think, I don't know that you'd have to store that much money per year or allocate that much per year.
Yeah, I mean, it's the way it was explained to me is it's a careful balance between, you don't want to have $400,000
right.
in him,
right.
because then, that just seems like not the greatest use of those funds at that moment. But you'll want to have something there, you know, the rainy day fund or whatever for when you do need to replace a roof. So it's kind of, again, it's at the board's discretion of mm-hmm. how conservative you might want to be on that. Mm-hmm. But I think if we just had enough set aside, even if we decided, which we probably should, to reseal the asphalt out here, you know, we should have some funds to dip into, because I'm sure that would not be an inexpensive mm-hmm. Process. I mean, it certainly wouldn't be $40,000-$50,000, but it mm-hmm. it may be tough on our operating budget. So that could come out of that, and then the next year we could replenish those funds and just kind of keep mm-hmm. up with that.
Right.
That so reserve balance.
So it might be kind of a lumpy. We might yeah. put some, whatever we determine to be the sufficient amount of money to put away, we put that away.
Yeah.
We deplete, if it gets depleted at what, our X year, then we replenish that, yeah. those funds again.
And it may even take 1 or 2 or 3 years to replenish those, but right. because of the cycle of things, we should be okay.
Mm-hmm. Aren't you doing kind of the same thing with your replacement vehicles? You say these are going to be replaced and so on and so forth. So here's these lumpy, I guess, chunks yeah. of money. So what you're saying is that perhaps the board every year should look at a recommendation from staff to say, all right, here are the things that we think that should show up maybe 2 years from now for this one, maybe it's 3 years for something else, but start building this list of possible things that could take some funds, and yeah. we're sort of planning in that yeah. direction.
The difference between our standard capital replacement plan and this is some of these things aren't that predictable. Mm-hmm. When your boiler decides to die on you, sometimes a boiler lasts 30 years and sometimes it lasts 10 years. And those are less predictable as opposed to some of the equipment that we have that's governed by NFPA standards and all those other things like turnouts and SCBAs. So that, you know, you just, again, it's finding that balance of, we feel like we've socked away enough for something to have the funds there to fix what needs to be fixed, but not going too crazy. And because we could war game out every single thing sure. breaking here and mm-hmm. end up with a gigantic fund that rarely gets used. And
yeah, we don't want to do that.
Yeah.
So do we really want to rename it as a separate fund, as a contingency, as you're using that word, as opposed to having it being part of one of the reserve categories that we have for repair or replacement?
How you name it is really...
Yeah, I think it's hard to see from here, at least for me anyway, but that, for this column to the right, is the building. What the heck is that called? That's what we're talking about.
Building repair and replacement.
Yeah, so that's the contingency fund. We could just call it, you know, building facilities contingency fund. And I guess then the question is, what's the number that we would like to have in there mm-hmm. that everybody feels comfortable with? And that could be an operational call that you guys make yeah. and say, we think we should have 30,000 is plenty, or maybe we should do 50. You know, I'm less concerned about coming up with the formula, because I think, like you said, we'll probably get to the same place. Mm-hmm. So why don't you just tell us what you think is comfortable, and then we can have more conversation about
it. I mean, if you guys, I think 40 would be a totally reasonable number to start with.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that would get us through most things.
Yeah, I think I agree. I we don't want to allow that fund to get too large.
Yeah.
Because I don't know that there would be much point.
No, I agree.
In having that accumulate to too large of an amount. You know, like what Jason mentioned, when he does the calculation on apparatus and equipment, it's a little bit easier to calculate what the annualized cost is going to be.
And the truth of the matter is, we could even go lower. I mean, we could go 30, because the one nice thing is that none of these, with the exception of the obligation bond that we have, none of them are truly restricted right. funds. So we could beg, borrow, and steal from our capital replacement fund if we needed to
sure.
right. some catastrophic accident that insurance didn't cover or whatever. We do have the ability to move monies around in that, other than the bond for this building. That's untouchable. But everything else, we can shift around by board action to accomplish those goals. So we could probably even do 30 and feel okay about right. that. And
And just for sort of an overview here, so members of the public and we're all on the same page, starting at the right is what we've been describing as a building contingency fund. Just talked about that. The middle thing is what's the title on that, Jason?
Capital improvement.
Capital improvement fund. And our thinking was there that we ought to have some monies that would alleviate the need to go to the taxpayers for mill levies to get ahead of future construction projects. So like if we were thinking in the next 3 to 5 years there's going to be a need for a new station, this fund would pay for the architectural fees, the funds to get that project started, right? And again, as Jason just described, it's completely fungible. The one on the far left is the one I think is really, really important. That shows us how we are doing against current replacement for the capital stock, essentially rolling stock.
Right.
Right? So the yellow is, I can't read, I'm sorry, Jason.
Average annual expense.
And then the blue is how we're doing against that annual.
That's the contribution. And yeah, so that'll vary from year to year.
That's the previous
year's contribution.
So to me, especially the one on the left is extremely useful, and I think the other two are as well.
Mm-hmm.
We got it to a good place where we're calling it what it is, so
right.
I'm happy with that. Is that working for you guys?
Very much.
Any public comment on the dashboard? Any more board conversation? So the next thing to do regarding this is to come up with that glossary that we talked about that explains that. So we'll take a look at that perhaps next meeting if we can get that done.
Yeah, and along those lines, I did speak with Rosie, and Rosie's amenable to making a presentation at February's meeting.
Perfect.
And so I suggested to Jason to maybe hold off on the glossary until Rosie makes her presentation, and then we could hone in a little bit more on what terms, you know, we'd like to have a little bit more in more detail instead of, you know, spending time on something that may not be necessary. I think if, you know, she makes her presentation and, you know, any members of the public are welcome to participate in that. In that presentation,
great.
Perfect. So it'll be a good opportunity to get a little bit more nuts and bolts perspective on all of our financial reports.
Any more board discussion on this item? Okay, thanks everybody for their work on that. Looks like it's getting into a good place. Now, the command vehicle.
Okay, so did quite a bunch of research. Quite a bunch of polling of our command officers and talking about what their needs are and for a command vehicle. You know, over the years we've kind of focused on Suburbans. We have that Expedition, and we have the Tundra pickup truck. What it came down to is most people felt that the pickup truck configuration was probably the most useful with the topper on the back, just having that extra space back there for throwing, you name it, back there, frozen hose and fires and everything else, and picking up water at Costco and everything else, just the pickup truck configuration. So did some shopping for prices, and in the end, the kind of two best all-around vehicles that we found was one was a Dodge 3/4-ton crew cab pickup truck. The other was a Toyota Tundra Crew Max, which is still considered a half-ton pickup truck. They're very comparable vehicles, white in color, not very fancy. We actually have to get more of a baseline truck. So many trucks nowadays, if you guys are into trucks, have too much console going on in the middle, and they have all the shifters in the middle and cup holders, and we can't mount any radios in there because of it. So we really need more of the old bench seat configuration where there's the leg room so we can mount radios and stuff in them. In the end, for pricing, The Toyota Tundra was out the door. Find my pricing. $38,450. And then I know a guy at the Dodge dealership. Names shall remain silent. Justin Miller. And he got us some really pretty great pricing on that three-quarter ton Dodge, which was $36,545 out the door, which is almost $2,000 cheaper than the Toyota. Justin was also, just so you guys understand what all of this is going to end up costing, he ended up getting us some good pricing on the topper from Big Sky Toppers with a first responder discount. And then a slide-out tray for the back. One of the difficulties with the pickup truck is you put the gear in, and then everybody's climbing in back out of the bed. And it's if you look at pretty much anybody's truck that's a command vehicle, the slide-out tray has become a standard. So so in total, the topper, the slide-out tray, and all that stuff, actually this price we can make a little lower because I think we need to go with the flat topper, not the raised. Because I think it'll obscure the light bar too much. And I know that was my call, but that should make it a little cheaper. And, but around the $3,800 mark for that add-on. And then to transfer the light bar off of Command 6-2, the radios, switch over, all the striping, the decals, and all that stuff, you could guess somewhere in the $2,500 range. Yeah, because we should be able to scab all of that because the light bar is good, the radios are good, all that stuff is good. The striping and the labeling and all that stuff, we'll have to, of course, can't reuse that. So I guess I don't really know if I want to ask the board to pick one of the two trucks. I'd prefer you just giving me the authority to choose which one, but I think the Dodge is looking like a great option for us. And
this is gas.
It's gas. Yeah.
Three long bed.
No. Short box.
Short box.
Yep, 6.5 foot.
Yeah, we don't want the wheelbase with a crew cab to get, you know, we need maneuverability at times.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Word discussion.
The slide-out box. How tall?
Oh, no, it's a tray.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just...
It's like 8 inches or something?
Yeah, yeah. It's just a...
It has different capabilities. You can put 12-inch walls on it if you want. It could be completely flat, but it's a full extension, so it gives you a full 6.5 foot that comes out of the bed. It actually has huge weight capacity. Someone can stand on the end of it while it's extended and jump on it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so it gives you the full 6.5 foot bed to come all the way out. You can walk around it, get whatever you need to slide the thing back in.
Is that considered a work truck label? I mean,
they call it a bed slide.
No. The 3/4 ton Dodge without the console and all that stuff.
It's a tradesman. So, okay. Yeah, it's a work truck kind of package.
I mean, it still has carpet in it. It's not, and it has power windows, and because roll up windows don't work in a command vehicle very well because people are always talking to you from either side of the vehicle. But it doesn't, you know, there's no heated seats and leather and fancy pantsy stuff. It's pretty straightforward.
Personally, I'm all for the Dodge myself over the Toyota.
Yeah, it's certainly looking like the better deal. And, you know, when we polled our command officers, they originally, if you had numbers, they really liked that Crew Max, that giant back seat in the back of the Toyota. But at almost $2,000 difference, I think the Dodge seems like a really good deal for us.
There's not that much difference between the rear and the Dodge and the Toyota, is there? It's just a couple.
I don't know what the configuration difference. The crew cab's pretty big in the rear.
I think it's adequate. Yeah. So, you know, this is just
crew cabs.
Yeah.
I mean, from our conversation earlier, if my input, if I was driving around all day long, you would think a half ton easier on the guys, easier to maneuver, easier to get around. You know, thinking about long term, you know, using it for dual purpose or something else, I understand.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, it's...
One of the advantages we saw, I mean, the nice thing about him getting is this excellent pricing on the 3/4 ton is that, you know, 10 years from now, that truck can be repurposed as a plow truck for us. And and that's, you know, that's an interesting, you know, there's only so much we can repurpose a half-ton pickup truck, but with a 3/4 ton, we actually have more options for repurposing that vehicle. So that seemed attractive as we discussed that.
So one point from a financial standpoint, too, if we look at the 30, say 36.5 roughly, and then adding about 43, because you said 38 for the topper and the slide out, 25 to transfer.
Yeah, and I'm giving you so rich prices there. It's that topper price is going to go down a little bit.
So I guess where I'm going, though, when we look at what was budgeted in the capital replacement plan, it was about 45 or so, right? Isn't
yeah.
it what we're budgeting for capital replacement?
Yeah.
So we would fall.
No, we're well within
fall,
that, yeah.
Fall within the guidelines on the capital.
Yeah, because that was kind of pricing based on the Suburban, and that's just a more expensive vehicle, quite honestly.
This is four-wheel drive?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I tried to kind of think outside the box, and it made a lot of people angry on the department. Of thinking, can we use a smaller vehicle?
Like a Prius?
Yeah, I did. No, that was a Subaru Outback. I mean, I really looked at all things, but the reality is we do cover Highlight Canyon, and we find ourselves, without a doubt, driving up Mosier Creek and all these other areas, and we need something durable to do that. I really tried to think of, God, how can we have a more fuel-efficient vehicle? And then some of our guys are 6'5", and you put them in a Subaru Outback, and there's nobody can sit behind them anymore. Even we looked at the Toyota double cab, which is still a crew cab, but not as big as the Crew Max. And when you have a 6'2" person, that you
trying to get in there with gears,
you can't put a toddler behind them in that configuration. So in a command vehicle, it's really important to have people be able to sit in the back seat, because when you sit at a fire, you have 3 or 4 people in there helping you run the incident. So.
Is there other stuff that you would want, like replacement bumpers, winches, anything like heavy duty on the front, or
no? I mean, you know, if we were Big Sky, yeah.
If you put a winch on it?
The winch. Yeah. They have a winch on their command vehicle. But no, I don't, as
Are
long as it has
winch
a
envy, is that what you're saying?
I might have winch envy. No, they got the Power Wagon. As long as it has a receiver hitch, which it does, that's all we would really need on it. Yeah.
Any more board discussion?
So, as I understand, there's 3 possible vehicles to replace. Do you pick the one you're going to replace?
Oh, absolutely. We're replacing the Expedition.
And why? And, you know, why that one of the 3? And then, is it replacing? Is it going to be repurposed? Or are you going to get some trade in or put it in the paper?
We'll probably put it in the paper and just sell it. It's the Expedition we got free. I got it salvaged from Malmstrom Air Force Base. And in salvage paperwork, it said it needed a new engine. Well, when I went and looked at it, it seemed to run pretty good. And it has lasted us a couple years, but it's going to need a new top end. I mean, the lifters are... It's a beautiful symphony if you like lifter noise, but it burns oil, it has a lot of lifter noise, and yeah, it's definitely, we've gotten our money's worth out of that.
Yeah, well, I guess I was curious whether there's going to be another vehicle here to use for the purpose.
No.
So there would be maybe this, if we're looking at 43,000, there may be 1,000, 1,500.
Yeah, we'll sell whatever we can get for it on Craigslist, yeah.
More board discussion. Any public comment? Okay, thank you. Just to remind the board, the way we exert our control over these things is exactly how Walt described it, within the budget and all that kind of stuff. And we approve the ice cream, and the chief gets to pick the flavor. Thank you for bringing that to us. Thank you for the interest, board, in the pickup truck. That was impressive. Knowledge of trucks. Nice.
Well, I guess before we go further, why not a Chevy or a Ford?
We did price those out and
more expensive.
Yeah, the half ton costs were more expensive than what he could get as the 3/4 ton for.
Yeah.
And thank you, Justin, for
yeah, that. Yeah, and the Toyota was cheaper, too. Awesome. The Chevys, we just couldn't get into one.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Oh, heated seats?
No heated seats, no. Just, they are cloth, though. They're not vinyl, so.
Can't all right, we're moving on. Okay. Policy. I don't think we need a motion. Do we need a motion?
We are expending capital replacement funds, so yes, I would say okay. That, yeah.
I will make a motion to approve the purchase of the new command vehicle, the Dodge, as described by the chief.
Any vehicle.
I think at the chief's discretion.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Policy subcommittee. We have before us all these policies. Hopefully we can get through them tonight, but if we want to table anything, we can certainly do that. Let me tell you the approach that Nick and I started with here. We got for about an hour a couple weeks ago. I can't remember to review these policies. And as I told you guys, doing policy for the sake of policy is not the purpose of this kind of stuff, but it is important to do. And I hope that once we get it to a baseline where we like it, then it's something that we review once a year and monkey with very, very little. And as we discovered, a lot of these policies were up on our website that were unsigned, which I think we all agreed was a bad business practice. So we pulled them all down and we're going through the motions of approving them, and that's where we are. Lon's done an excellent job of getting them into a format. And when Nick and I met about this, before we got into any of the policies, and Nick, correct me if I get any of this wrong, we sort of agreed that what we were trying to do is describe the principles that we wanted each policy to address. So we're trying to avoid getting into the weeds and trying to proscribe every particular eventuality that we came up with, but rather start with the question, what is this policy intended to do? And that's how we started when we were going through this review process. And then finally to write them for real clarity. So Nick took a stab at wordsmithing most all these policies, and he sent me the documents, and I just accepted all his changes, and then went through and cleaned them up to meet the last standard, so writing for clarity going forward. And the only one where I took real liberty was with the alcohol policy, and we'll get to that as we go there, but I just wanted the other board members to get some insight to how we went about this process.
So do we have a copy of the previous installation of these before any revisions occurred?
No, we don't. We're looking at clean copies, and we made that decision.
So we could
make some progress going forward. So
do we have an idea of what types of changes? Like, for example, the invoice processing. Do we have an idea of what kind of changes were made?
The changes that we made in here, and again, we can do this any way you want. I made the executive decision not to go through a redlining policy and just give you guys clean versions to look at. So I looked at the policy and I made a determination whether there were significant changes or whether Nick, he was the only board member that provided feedback, was just wordsmithing. And amongst all these things, it was just wordsmithing changes. So I kept, almost in their entirety, the original policies. The alcohol policy is the exception, which I amended quite a bit because I didn't feel it was sufficient. So that's where we are.
So are we going to go through this policy?
Yeah, we're going to start with the invoice policy. And again, this was just, our invoice policy is totally straightforward. It's administrative in its procedure. And the principle that we were trying to apply to this is to provide guidance to the staff, obviously transparency to the public, and make sure that we have a system of checks and balances in place to protect the district residents. So.
Does the public have copies of the policies or not?
Yes, they're in the packet.
They're in the packet, so we
So this, I guess I'm looking through, and I don't have, were there substantial changes made?
No.
Didn't look like.
Now, most of these, if you take a look at these policies, we have the invoice policy, the meeting agenda policy, travel and meal reimbursement. These are really pretty straightforward kind of items.
So it was just truly some wordsmithing on that?
Yeah.
Because it looks like all the items are pretty much.
Yep.
The process was.
I might just state from looking through that, I looked into, and in the existing thing we have here, we have policy, and I had suggested that we have a procedure, because most of what's in that policy is procedure of what goes done, when and where. And so I would suggest that under the policy has two bullets, and then there would be the title procedure, because from there on down, it gives the steps 1, 2, 3 through 6. It gives detailed how the invoices travel through the system, the checks get written, and all of that, and that changed very little. The only other thing that changed in that is instead of having two words, invoices and receipts, we change it to just invoices, which is by definition an itemized listing of what we're paying on. Receipt is just an acknowledgement that something happened, and a statement is a summary of a bunch of invoices or whatever that may be due. And so as I look at what was done, I would suggest we'd add the word procedure as what most of this is, and then on B3, we still use the word receipt. It should have been invoice, missing invoice. And then line 4, the next line on number 4 also said invoices and receipts. We want to delete and receipts would be my suggestion. So that's all talking about invoices here, because that's the true legal document that we're paying.
So where are you seeing receipts?
Well, it's been all changed except item 3 on the procedure.
Oh, it's
under B3, it says attaches approved invoices and missing receipts. So, approved invoices and missing invoices. So it's the word receipts. The word receipt needs to be changed to invoice, in my opinion. And then on the next line, on number 4, again, it has and receipts. It should be invoices. So that's really about the only thing that really changed in there. Just
try to be a little more specific. So I understand you don't want to use the term receipt.
That's right.
From an operational standpoint, like for us as staff, there's a distinct difference between an invoice and an invoice is to be paid. A receipt has already been paid, and you don't want to differentiate between the two.
Well, you pay invoices. You know, a receipt says you may have paid something, but it's not an itemized. If you look at the definition, as I understand it, a receipt is a document that acknowledges something's been received. But an invoice is where we say how many nuts and bolts or how many gallons or how many kilowatt hours, and those are invoices. And I think to have the term invoices and receipts is contradictory, because you're really paying just invoices.
Well, I don't know that that's, I think a good example where that's not the case is food. Some of the food that's purchased that's not purchased through Town and Country. If a firefighter goes to purchase food to pay for food for a post-incident, they have to submit a receipt, and then we don't get an invoice.
Yes, you do. I think every place I go to buy food, McDonald's, wherever, they say it's a hamburger, it's a this or it's that, it's an itemized, and it's an invoice, because it lists what it is was purchased.
It's a receipt.
You can call it a receipt, and a lot of people do, but in fact, if you look in the dictionary, it's an invoice.
Well, I guess that might be a rosy question, but my understanding is a receipt. I mean, that's those types of paperwork are referred to as receipts, but I don't know the dictionary definition of an invoice.
Yeah, that seems to be commonsensical to me.
Yeah.
That's what I call those things, receipts.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, again, I'm totally happy with keeping invoices and receipts in here, especially if we get a comment from the staff saying it helps us out operationally. Again, back to principles, is this policy as written and revised here doing what we want it to do? And I think it is. So getting down in the weeds, I don't want to spend a lot of time, guys.
Well, and that's one thing, I mean, after going to that meeting that we went to a couple minutes ago and listening to some of the stories and the presentations that were made, you know, our system, I think, is incredibly robust.
Right.
The number of people that are laying eyes on this and the process that's involved with the final component of the audit, we have about as robust a financial system as there exists in the state. It's on top of the heap.
Okay, is there more board discussion about the invoicing policy?
Yeah, of course. Make one more statement about it. You're absolutely right. There's nothing wrong with this procedure, and it's not changed. We do have a procedure, and it's very robust, and it's very detailed. But we are calling it, or it's called an invoice processing policy. And an invoice is an itemized document. You can call it a receipt, but if it doesn't have on it what it is you purchased, whether it's nuts, bolts, hamburgers, or whatever, and I think if I understand, and signing checks and looking at what has been done when I work with Lana, that she goes and looks for missing documents that don't, and that she has to have to specify what it is that was purchased. And it isn't just a receipt or a credit card receipt that $10 was spent on Visa at McDonald's. It's the device at McDonald's that says what the items are. And that to me is, that's the bottom line. I mean, it's what it is, what an invoice is by definition. So that's my argument. If you don't want to do that, that's fine. You don't put all those words.
So dictionary, the significant difference between the two is invoice is issued prior to the payment while the receipt is issued after the payment. The issue is, I don't know. So I think that it's perfectly fine the way it's
Yeah, right. But the point is that the invoice is what you had to pay on, and the receipt says, yes, a payment was made. But we have in our record that what it was that purchased was on that invoice. So maybe she logs just the invoices and not just the receipts.
You know, the receipts, when we get a food, it's after payment. We get the food is a good example because they don't receive that until after payment. When you put your credit card, they get that after the payment. It's a receipt on that payment for a food item or food items that were purchased.
And an invoice is a bill that's sent to us that we need to make payment for what goods that we've received that haven't been paid for.
And those are attached. All the food receipts are attached on the, when you look at the warrants, they're attached to each of those.
So if I could go to look at each of those receipts, I can see the items of food that were purchased.
Well, pretty much, yes.
Much.
Yes.
Yeah. Next question.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
They're an itemized receipt.
Yeah. So that's an invoice. But if you want to call a receipt,
well, it's not because it's
itemized is a key word. That's
right.
The one thing.
Yep.
Itemized. If you want to use receipt, I would accept itemized invoice or slash receipt, not and or, but something itemized. That's the whole key to this whole thing.
Okay. In the judgment of the chair, we've made this distinction clear. Is there any other board discussion on the invoicing policy? Is there any public comment on the invoicing policy? Can I have a motion to approve the invoicing policy as presented?
Motion to approve the invoicing policy as presented.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Meeting policy. The meeting policy, I thought Nick had an excellent suggestion there, and that was to incorporate ways for members of the public to get items put on the meeting agendas. So again, I tried to start all these things with a statement saying the purpose of this policy is to, and that was to let people know that any meeting we're having, so if we're having a special meeting, if we're having any publicly noticed meeting that we're having, that people, members of the public, have access to the agenda. And Nick, I thought, made an excellent comment to limit it to people who I call them qualified residents of the district, so that they'd be taxpayers. So we just don't have people coming from Belgrade that don't really have any business before us. And then just described out the procedure for creating the public meeting agendas, which we're following now, and providing notice for people to get their business before us. That's pretty much it. Entertain board discussion when you all have something to say about it.
So when you're referring to members of the public, you're referring to the statement, qualified members of LA Rural Fire District, is that? Those are?
Taxpayers.
Taxpayers.
Yeah, I figured qualified members is definitional.
And it's subject to the same rules then, so the chair say in the board.
Again, you know, going back to the principles that Nick and I discussed, what we want to do here is, A, let the public know they can get agendas, items on the agenda. And I think what you want to do is you want to prevent the board chair from vetoing agenda items. You want to give the board a mechanism to override the chair's objections. And Nick had, I think, some quite good comments there about, you know, if there's something going to be denied, it'll be included on the agenda and there will be an explanation and all that kind of stuff. So this, from my perspective, is really just a good governance issue to prevent sort of rogue chairs and rogue boards from doing stupid stuff.
Just a really quick one. This address is wrong.
I have some dyslexia sometimes.
The storm says 4145 South Third instead of 4541.
The thing that before, the agenda of every is policy. It says the agenda for every regular or special highlight Rural Fire District Board of Trustee meeting will be established by the current chair person. Bylaws say there's another classification of meetings, and that's called an emergency meeting. The bylaw specifies that a person, three or more members, I think, of the board can call an emergency meeting. And whoever's calling that meeting, those three people are the ones who are going to set that agenda. You may not, the chair may not be part of that emergency meeting, according to the bylaws. So I think we need to put a classification in that sentence that says that the for the, and we don't mention the annual meeting either, but for every regular, annual, or special highlight district, the chair is responsible for the agenda, but in the bylaws, an emergency meeting, the agenda needs to be set by the three people, three or more people who are going to do it. Maybe the chair of one of them.
Yes, I'm looking at a different draft than you are. I'm looking at the one that's in our packet. And I said, procedures for creating public meeting agendas. Agenda creation for all meetings. And I can't read it because the big draft
is. Sorry about that. Here's a clean version.
Yeah, we can get a little bit lighter draft in the.
I know. I printed it with just black and instead of gray. Sorry.
So I said agenda creation for all meetings is the responsibility of the board chair, or in his absence, the vice chair. Now, if we need to put a particular clause in there about those emergency meetings, I'm perfectly happy to do that. Because emergency meetings may be called.
If it's in there, I obviously don't have the right.
So
somehow or another, I got the wrong, because I have just a procedure and I don't have a
Is that, were those from your original, from your policy, for your subcommittee meeting or something?
No, this is one that, well, I thought it was the one that I got.
Yes, this is what was distributed.
It came to me over the computer, wasn't it sent to me? Maybe this is not the one that got put in the packet, so I apologize, I'm one step behind apparently.
So I would defer to you, Lana, to just take a look at the bylaws. But clearly the intent here is for any time that this board is meeting with the chair or not present, like there's a procedure and a policy in place to create the agenda.
Okay, I'll look at that.
Yeah, somehow or other.
Yeah, this should be, and this, I believe this is the one that you sent me, Pete, that you sent me back, so, correct?
Mm-hmm, yeah, I believe so.
I think all meetings,
what's that?
All meetings, verbiage, does.
Don't you think?
That's pretty general.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, if all meetings are in there, I apologize.
I mean, again, I'm just trying to write this stuff so it's just plain and simple. And, you know, anybody can understand it. So by definition, an emergency meeting is a meeting.
And I do like the mechanism that's in place for members of the public to provide input on a possible agenda item within.
So Nick, these are the ones.
Somehow or other.
Another thing you guys may consider, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a policy item, but we could put on our website about how a member of the public can, because the most important thing is, when I was in Big Sky, this happened a lot, that developers and other people wanted to be on the agenda for something, to have kind of a drop date of saying by, 2 weeks prior to the meeting. That way you guys have time to put it in the agenda and get it publicized.
We've got seven days.
At least
before the meeting?
I think that's not enough time.
At least 7 business days prior to the meeting.
You guys tell me.
I think the 7 days.
Because that's when we typically...
No, that's...
So the Tuesday prior is...
Well, 7 business days. Yeah, so that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just want to make sure.
Because that's when I first contact the board about the draft agenda. So there would be time to get those requests handled.
Okay, any more board discussion on that?
Does it say on that? I'm missing it, but it doesn't say where the public needs to do the same 7 days if they're going to turn, they have to turn in a written.
It's right under it procedure for requesting inclusion of items on the agenda.
Yeah, I think that would apply because it applies to all meetings. So these statements.
It doesn't say anything about the public and the four dots I've got here. Maybe I'm missing something.
There's a.
Is that what we're looking at, these four under previous?
Let me pass that down to me.
On this next page. Yes, where it says all qualified members. That's the.
There it is.
Yeah, any qualified member of Highlight Rural Fire District.
Do we need to put that 7-day rule there as the public needs to do, just as it does?
Well, it's in there, isn't it?
Yep. Make the request in writing.
Seven
business days prior to the meeting. They'd be by mail.
Nick, look at this version that's sitting in front of Pete. It's got.
I think, yeah.
You can read it better.
It's on the back page.
Okay, any more board discussion on the meeting agenda policy? Any public comment on the meeting agenda policy? All right. Can I have a motion?
Motion to approve board meeting agenda policy.
Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All right. Travel and meal reimbursement policy. Okay. Oh, thank you. So I got double copies here.
You got the right one.
Okay, so sort of thinking on this one was we came up with, a trustee travel policy, and we figured we just ought to roll that into staff, volunteers, the whole bit. And as we say in the purpose, this policy does not apply to food and meals that are done as a regular course of training activities and fire operations. So this is when Brian is going out to Milwaukee to see the Pierce fire truck, or Nick's heading up to Great Falls, or you know, Jason decides to send a bunch of volunteers to the Super Bowl in Las Vegas. This would cover that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And I like, I mean, it's a even application to everybody.
Yeah.
The whole, whole organization.
100% of the GSA thing. You had like a 75%, which I didn't understand why, so I just figured.
GSA only allows 75% on the first day of travel.
First day of
100%
travel.
100%
after. Yeah. So we can talk about that if you want to. But
yeah, the only thing I noticed here is somehow or another the gratuity. It was a gratuity policy to kick this off, but there's no gratuities mentioned in here. So is that saying that the tax of gratuity on any particular food item, that goes away because you can only be reimbursed to the 100% of the per diem? And if it's a, let's say it's a $10 lunch, then the 100% is what you get. You get $10, and if you pay $10 for your lunch, then you put a tip and tax on that. If that would be a tax, then you're going to pay more. I guess the word gratuity, I think I lost it. Maybe it's in here, but I don't.
What's this top line right here, 120%?
No, that was the original. That was the first iteration of this travel policy.
Oh, I see.
So that iteration, that changed. June 19th, I guess.
And can I just ask a clarification question? So the 100%, say, per diem for meals and incidentals, so would a traveler be given that flat 100% amount or up to that amount of their actual expenses?
So, me at work, if I tip someone and I put a tip amount, they pay me 100% of whatever I paid.
Right.
And so it's not the original charge. If I tip someone $5 or something, they pay the full tip and pay everything.
Right.
So your question is, if the GSA rate, if your airfare is 60% of GSA rate, do you reimburse up to 100%? Is that your question?
Well, my question, yes, I guess is, so you're saying, all travel will be reimbursed at 100% of the GSA rates. So if the GSA rate for air travel is $500, do I get $500 even if my ticket was just $300?
So no,
okay.
I would say.
So up
that's
to.
That's not what we want to do, so we want to put the phrase up to in there.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Reimbursed up to
up
for
to.
Actual.
Yeah.
Expense.
Right. And I think,
yeah, so all travel costs will be reimbursed at their actual rates, up to 100%.
Okay.
And each locality from GSA has a breakfast amount, a lunch amount.
Do we have to have GSA in there?
We can have whatever we want in there. But
I just think if you're going to California for something, and it's you do your due diligence and search, the area for hotels, and the cheapest one is, $150, but GSA only pays $70. Reimburse $150. I don't understand why we have to have Lana look up what the GSA rate is every time something's getting reimbursed. That's my opinion.
I can make an explanation of that. I think the...
So if we're sending him on training for something that we want him to go to, he has to pay everything over $70? If GSA only says $70, but it's $130, doesn't make any sense to me.
So we are spending government money, public money. The GSA is a standard, and for every locale, every county in the country, it has a GSA rate. It has a rate for hotels, has a rate for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Travel is different. So those items, and there's a per diem rate per day, that breakfast, lunch, and dinner adds up, plus there's maybe an incidental in there. But the idea is that we have a fixed standard, no matter where we go, that the public knows that the travel that's done, we're paying for with that public money, meets the 100% of the GSA rate. And so no matter where you go, whether you go to Missoula, or you go to Wisconsin, you go to California, Los Angeles is going to be a lot higher on the GSA rate than it is, say, somewhere else. So that's the rate. Now that seems to me a fair and equitable and a defensible and a constant way that we can pay for our travel.
So quick question for staff. Does Highlight Rural Fire District qualify to ask for GSA rates if you travel somewhere? Yeah, there's one of the problems that we can run into. It's not like some federal organizations and so on where you have an ID where you can ask for a GSA rate and get GSA rate.
So Lana couldn't even call up.
And get GSA rate. You can, right.
Now you can get that for travel, right?
Right,
we can get for it mileage.
Correct.
I'm sorry, mileage, right? Because there's a...
And the food. We could do it for food, we could do it for mileage, but I don't know that you can do it. If you go to the Milwaukee example,
yeah,
and you get a hotel room, I don't think you can ask for GSA rates at a hotel room. Or, you know, like with MSU, you can ask for state rates when you travel too.
Yeah. So the two principles that Nick and Jason have espoused, I completely agree with.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to stick Jason for a hotel room because we want him to go to these training sessions. And if it is the case that we can't get those GSA rates, the way we could get over this is just to pre-approve his travel. So you say, I got to go to Milwaukee. I got a hotel for $195 a night. It's like, right? I mean, that's one way we could get around that. Or we could just, I mean, 100 different ways to skin this guy.
Well, and I think the point that Justin raised too about due diligence. I mean, if Lana does, you know, if she's looking up the rooms for these guys on the travel project that they have to work on. I don't know if that's the standard process now that Lana's in place and where she's looking up some of the rooms and so on. If, you know, if she's looking up, doing the due diligence on finding a reasonable room. I don't want to, you know, put them in the slum somewhere, but a reasonable room and, you know, and reapprove.
Well, so he goes to California for training, and the training just so happens to be in a Hilton. And they've got a block of rooms in the Hilton, and the Hilton costs $150 a night.
Stay in the Hilton.
Jason could move down the street and pay $100 a night, but then he's missing out on all the other guys.
I think that's a reasonable due diligence.
Yeah, but I don't think that we need to have GSA in there on anything.
Well, I think the GSA, I guess, I don't know. I feel comfortable with the GSA for meals, and I know that sometimes that means that you're not going out to, you're not being fully compensated, and that's just kind of the way it goes, I think, sometimes. But I know that happens a lot with state projects. If you decide to have a nicer meal, you're not going to be fully compensated. I mean, it's not like a private sector business.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a choice that has to be made there. And so I think we do need to be careful. That was one of the justifications for the original 120% to
because GSA typically doesn't cover, you know, an average kind of sets a bunch of meals and stuff. It typically doesn't cover that stuff.
So can it be more clear of just saying, you know, he's got $50 a day for meals, or $40 a day for meals, or just, you know, and then anything over that he knows he has to pay for? If he spends $10 at McDonald's and then he gets $25 for dinner or something? I mean,
you do know that with the GSA. When you go, you do know how much you're going to get compensated for that locale. Yeah. So you know what your budget's going to be.
Here's what happens on the GSA. If you, on your per diem, if you get $75 a day per diem, so much for the breakfast, so much lunch for the dinner, you're at the hotel at the conference, chances are your conference meal is already paid for two or three of those. So you're not paying any lunch, so you have that dollar in your pocket. Then you also have usually the hotel breakfast, and you're not having to pay that out. So it usually comes down to an evening meal that you have up to $75 to pay for your steak and lobster and drinks or whatever else you want to do. So the idea, though, of the public being able to say, all right, there's a fixed level of spending that we're going to do and have some limit, GSA is basically the standard.
And right. No. There's no question that's the standard, and that's nice. But the now you get into the operational problem of trying to figure out if we don't have access to the GSA rates.
It's on.
Okay. And maybe there's just an even simpler way to do this, because you recall we spent a lot of time talking about this in the context of the district reimbursing alcohol, right? So if we set mileage aside for a moment, because we can figure that out, we could, because what we do not want to do here, I think we're all in agreement, is discourage staff, trustees, from traveling for educational purposes that advance the mission of the district, right? That's a good thing, okay? What we're trying to do is to provide some transparency for the public, and as you suggested, be responsible for taxpayer dollars. We're all in agreement on that. So then the question becomes, how do we write this policy to meet those things? We could say that we have a travel budget that controls this, right? So we don't really give a rat's ass until Jason says, you know what, I need $5,000 more in the travel budget. We're like, what? Right? I mean, we really don't. This is like, you know, the thing we got to earlier. We tell him we're going to approve buying the ice cream, whatever color flavor he wants is up to him. So we could just not worry about it because it's covered in the budget. But we could specifically say that the district will not pay for alcohol when people are traveling. We'll keep a mileage reimbursement in there and write some global statement about, you know, travel and lodging should be responsible and blah, 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 blah. That's another way to go about doing it. Mm-hmm.
I suggest that we just move this one to another meeting.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Committee.
Yeah, it has to be redrafted. But again, what I'm trying to get at is let's not have another discussion about principles at the next meeting. Let's have a discussion about is the wording that we're writing advancing what we want here? And as I understand it, we want to certainly not pay for alcohol when people are on the road. We want to encourage travel. And if it is the case that Lana can't get on GSA and figure out what that hotel rate is in Fort Lauderdale that they're going to for training, then let's just come up with some reasonable statement in here and alert the public that this really is controlled through the budgetary process. We have a travel budget, and if we allocate $3,000 for travel in a year and we're not overspending it, then I don't think it's a good use of this board's time to figure out, to be concerned if Jason's spent $2,200 of that travel budget or $2,500. You know, just in the same way that we're not worried about him buying a Dodge or a Toyota because it's underneath the total cap. Now that's just one operating principle that we could use to solve this problem.
Yeah, I guess I would be comfortable with present your travel budget for whatever it is, find out what the expenses are for rooms, and then just I think per diem for meals and incidentals and the mileage reimbursement,
at federal, those probably make sense. And then just whatever it is for a room, you know, Milwaukee or Fort Lauderdale or wherever it is, and, you know, pre-approved travel.
Do we want, now, again, I've never worked under a per diem system, but my understanding is per diem is you're allotted that money whether you spend it or not. Do we want to use that term?
I don't particularly like that system at all.
Yeah, I mean, I've always worked under the you turn in your receipts and get reimbursed, not you're just given the money and,
yeah, and
you
I'd
can
actually
eat
be...
peanuts in your room all day and then you pocketed.
Right.
Buy a new motorcycle.
Right. And actually,
yeah, exactly.
Ultimately, I'd be more comfortable with that, but we had a very long discussion several months ago about the per diem thing. And I actually, from my perspective, from this one trustee's perspective, I would be more comfortable with turning in the receipts.
Right.
For, and sans alcohol, you turn in the receipts, that's what you get.
That's what you get back. I agree with that totally.
Okay, so what I'll do is I will, how do you guys feel about this? I will wordsmith this policy and I'll send it around to all of us electronically, right? We'll be careful about not having meetings electronically, but so you can all pipe in on those comments, and then we'll bring a clean version back next board meeting.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
That sounds good? I'll run it by you too.
Okay.
Okay, great. Alcohol and tobacco use. What I wanted to do with this policy, what Nick and I wanted to do, we talked a lot about this, was to make sure that, and you guys may remember, maybe it's a decade ago, Bridger King just got into a total meltdown over this when they had, I think it was private donors giving to the construction of a community room, and they wanted to have alcohol in it, and the fire chief said no, and it just was meltdown from the get-go. So what we wanted to do here was to, since members of the public are using our community room, is ban the consumption of alcohol on operating facilities of the district. At the same time, I was at the Christmas party. I thought that was a fantastic event, and there was alcohol there, which I was absolutely fine with, as long as the district is not providing it. And when we were kicking this back and forth, we have this incredibly detailed employee manual that absolutely covers the consequences for a volunteer responding to a call under the influence of alcohol. So we don't need to do that in this policy. Rather, what Nick and I thought we would do is reference the volunteer handbook and the employee manual, and when this goes on the web, that'd be hot linked, so you could go right to those. And then we had a conversation about illicit drugs and vaping and all that kind of stuff, and our thinking on that was illicit drugs are by definition illicit, so you get in trouble for that. And then again, you know, if we try to prescribe every new thing that might come down the pike that we don't like, I just don't think that's worth it. I think, you know, it's a little bit like the Chief Justice said, you know pornography when you see it, and we don't need to try to get down in the weeds here on this. So that's what I did with this policy, and I made it, I particularly referenced celebrations that we host that are not on site. You recall that thing was up at Triple Tree. And I want to keep those sorts of celebrations. I think they're really important for the morale and camaraderie of the organization. And we trust these volunteers who are of age to legally drink to do hazardous stuff on our behalf, and they'll treat them like adults. And again, I got no problem with that as long as the district is not providing the alcohol. So that was our thinking on that. And we got it down to a pretty straightforward kind of a thing.
There's a key.
So one page, points 1 and 2.
Yeah, and referencing the handbook, yeah, I think this looks great.
Mm-hmm. More discussion?
I'm comfortable with it.
Public comment. Is there a motion to approve the policy as presented?
I will make that motion to approve the alcohol and tobacco policy.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Great. So we just got one of those to work on, and then we'll bring these back for signature at the next meeting, and then posting. Excellent.
Actually, you can sign them tonight if you like.
Before we move on, do we need to, just come up later, do we want to set two or three other policies we may need to be working on and suggest to think about it as well?
Which ones are we thinking about?
Well, there should be a meeting policy in terms of limiting speaking, and then I think the other policy we had. I think there's two or three other policies out there we talked about. I can't remember.
That would be like conduct of work meetings. Well, I think it like the pub is limited or something like that.
I think it'd be good to have someday maybe there might be a room full of people. And I think we get in trouble if we have a policy that says typically the public is limited to 2 minutes per presentation. If we have that written up, there's only one person, they want to talk a half hour, that's fine. There's 50 people there and they say, oh, well, you don't let us talk. And we're saying, no, it's right here, we've got 2 minutes apiece. So I think that's a policy that I think out of risk and out of governance, that I think we probably need to public comment. I mean, that's a suggestion I would make that we think.
I wonder if we could just handle it. And so I've been to lots of public meetings where we have full rooms for sure. What we did was we sort of laid out the ground rules for those particular meetings. So we
started
writing policy, we said, and we just read, it was publicly noticed, public comments are going to be limited to 4 minutes and 37 seconds.
If it's a public comment, noticed that way, so that's another way.
Yeah, that's the way this board member would prefer to handle that.
Okay. And let me ask Lana, are there any other policies in the summary that you've put together that need to be addressed?
Yes, there are a few. And there's also a new one on the public records request that I did get back from the county attorney. And I think because the alcohol and tobacco policy references the employee and the volunteer manuals, those probably ought to be reviewed as well. Does the board approve those, or do those get approved by chief? Those more operating.
I think the board for sure are to have the ability to make comments on those.
So
but
those
the chief has generally driven that train and sought outside counsel when he thought it was necessary.
So I can give you a list of the still outstanding items or kind of prepare a number of items for the next subcommittee.
Yeah, let's just keep chugging through these things. We'll take another crack at it. Great.
So the response that you received from the county and public records, is it kind of written in a policy format?
So I had drafted an initial version that I sent to them, and it's still in that form. There were a few updates, but not too many. So
great.
I think it's in pretty good shape.
Okay, fire chief's report.
Given that we have kind of a long meeting, is there any questions about the fire chief's report?
Looks good to me.
I'll find it first. Somewhere.
So what was the story on the structure?
Pardon me?
Oh, what was the story on the structure fire?
It was a mutual aid call to Fort Ellis for a residential structure fire that they had. And so it went really well. Our guys did just a tremendous job. They were very thankful for our help and support. Very classic winter time fire.
Made those two right angle turns getting up to Fort Ellis okay?
December, that's January
9th. Who's the genius who designed that one?
Yeah, we did. You made it okay.
It must be great. My last page. So we got two of them.
Yeah, she's got last month's and this month's.
The last month's was in, that was for the consent agenda, I believe.
So comparison, 510 calls comparison to, it's like
last year we were right at 500.
Mm-hmm.
How's your, is the 911 thing, or you're helping the city still?
No, I'm done with that.
Any board comment? More board discussion? Any public comment on the chief's report? Okay, trustee activities.
Again, the only thing I have is that, well, that Rosie's presentation next month.
I'm sorry?
We'll have Rosie's presentation next month.
Looking forward to it. Anything else? Should we go right into the next board meeting? That would be the 19th of February. Highly likely I will be in California.
Oh, I'm pretty flexible, so I can adjust to whatever we need to do.
How's 26 look for everybody?
26 is fine for me.
Fine.
So you're not going to be there on the third Tuesday, is that?
Highly unlikely. 26 will create.
Well, may or may not. I may have to do an electronic meeting, but I don't know where my schedule is. Okay. So yeah, it's fine. I just keep trying to be consistent on the third Tuesday. I just think it's a better thing for the public to have.
Yeah, consistent time. I'm happy to call in. I just can't guarantee I'll be available. So, you know, no reason to move it just for me. You guys want to keep it the 19th?
That would be my preference. But
okay. Let's do that.
You're on deck.
Yep. Is that I'm fine with the 26th. But
okay. Doesn't matter to me. I mean, keep it. Doug, you can just change it for me. That's fine.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not as well as anybody else.
I mean, I'm not going to die on the sword. I just. Ooh.
No, you're not dying on the sword.
19th is the third Tuesday, and that's consistent with all I was kind of looking for. But whatever the group wants is fine with me.
All right, anything else? Any announcements?
19th is it?
Yeah, we'll keep on the 19th. Okay, we are going to adjourn this meeting and then reopen an executive session. Do the chief's report.
So you can just leave the recording going and I'll be able to split them.
Thanks for coming, Mr. White.
Just one comment. You didn't ask for a public comment on the travel and meal. So I'm just going to make my comment.
Okay.
You know, I was at the meeting where everything came apart on this travel and meal because somebody was drinking a few beers. They were getting reimbursed for however many beers they drank. So I'm just going to comment that, you know, the GSA sure solved a lot of problems with that.
Yeah, we do not tend to replicate that mistake.
That's all I was going to comment.
Okay. Thanks very much for coming.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.